History of Little Europe, Episode 1.19, Almost a Revolution. In the last episode, I covered the Swiss World War I experience and its striking connection to a series of communist revolutions. In this episode, we will watch as some of that communist air drifts over the Swiss state. As we discussed in the last episode, Switzerland was in something of a unique position following the conclusion of World War I, not just in the fact that it kept its economy rolling and factories open, but that its progressive agenda did not regress. I offhandedly mentioned last episode that Lenin was disgusted by his colleagues across Europe who, in a time of crisis, lined up behind their nation instead of pressing the agenda further. But the truth was that this happened regardless of political ideology. Across the board, from centrists to radicals, progressive agendas were set back decades. Such a process still occurs today, which partially explains the resurgent conservative movement following 9/11 in the United States, but I'm getting off track. The point is, Switzerland was in a very unique position, because rather than being suppressed, progressive movements were agitated by the war. This agitation was attributable to the state of the Swiss economy following the conclusion of the war. Even though its industry and labor pool survived the ordeal in one piece, the economic downturn following the conclusion of the war hurt the economy regardless. The result was hundreds of thousands of Swiss soldiers who had been mobilized without compensation and now found themselves without jobs to return to. Those who did were met with pressure to work for longer hours and less money, with the supply of people looking for jobs far outstretching the demand. And when workers find themselves with little to lose and everything to gain, they begin agitating for revolution. The results were, in hindsight, predictable. The SP, the Social Democratic Party, which I introduced a few episodes back, alongside the USS/SGB, which together formed the basis of the organized communist movement in Switzerland, swept up this new wave of animosity and steered it for its own agenda. In February 1918, the two groups, alongside the socialist press, came together to create the Olten Action Committee, or OAK. Its purpose was to provide unified leadership to the labor movement and the Socialist Party. It was led by Robert Grimm, the editor of the socialist newspaper Berner Tagwacht, and a member of the lower house of parliament. The other members were Friedrich Schneider and Rosa Bloch as representatives of the SP, and Karl Dürr, Konrad Ilk, August Hugler, and Franz Reichmann as representatives of various labor unions. On November 5, 1918, the Federal Council deployed two infantry regiments and two cavalry brigades to Zurich. It claimed that economic and political instability could give radicals, particularly foreigners in Zurich, the opportunity to cause disturbances and to attempt a revolution that the soldiers were needed to maintain order. The troops marched into Zurich on November 7th. This move angered the city's labor organizations, who accused the government of seeking to establish a military dictatorship. The OAK also protested the government's decision. It called for a one-day strike in 19 cities on November 9th, a Saturday. This ended up being mostly ineffective, as many cities did not participate, citing not enough time to prepare. Still, the message was sent, and the scope of operations was a clear signal of the size of the movement. In Zurich, however, labor leaders considered the committee's one-day strike overly cautious and vowed to continue the struggle until the army withdrew from the city. The next day, a Sunday, Zurich's labor movement had made plans to celebrate the first anniversary of the Russian October Revolution. The same day, news of the German November Revolution and the toppling of the German Emperor reached Zurich. Suddenly, it seemed as though Europe was about to enter a series of revolutions not seen since those of 1848. The military at once banned all public demonstrations. When troops dispersed a crowd on the Münsterplatz Square, the resulting disorder left four protesters injured and one soldier dead. Protesters reassembled, but were attacked by cavalry bearing sabers, forcing them to flee. The altercations in Zurich forced the OAK to act. Its members discussed their options in a long and tumultuous meeting that evening. In the end, the committee issued a proclamation entitled to the working people of Switzerland. The proclamation called for a general strike beginning on November 11th, the exact same date that World War I officially concluded, and made 9 demands. A new national council elections with proportional representation, women's suffrage and women's right to hold office, a general right to work, the 48-hour work week, the reorganization of the military into a people's army, improving the food supply, establishment of old age and disability insurance, establishment of a state monopoly on foreign trade, and forcing the rich to pay off the country's sovereign debt. As expected, the Federal Council immediately rejected the committee's demands. It left the door open to social reforms, but insisted they could only be accomplished through legal procedures. It called on the Swiss people to side with the government. The government also placed all federal employees under military law, subject to punishment if they participated in the strike. It mobilized the army, some 110,000 soldiers. Furthermore, the Swiss government decided to close down the Soviet Union's diplomatic mission in Bern. Its staff, including the mission chief, John Bertzen, were escorted to the German border on November 12th. The general strike started as planned on Tuesday, November 12th. Participation was greatest in the industrial areas of German-speaking northern and eastern Switzerland. In Zurich and Basel, workers were particularly enthusiastic. Even workers who might not otherwise have taken part in the strike, particularly those in rural areas, were prevented from commuting to work because the trains did not run. In the French-speaking half of Switzerland, support was far lower. French speakers held more support for the Allies in World War I, and some suspected Grimm of harboring sympathy for the Germans. Still, there were no major incidents on the first day of the strike. On November 12th, both chambers of the Swiss legislature assembled for a special session, with some delegates requiring military assistance to reach Bern. By a vote of 136-15, the Federal Assembly passed several measures designed to break the strike after 2 days of debates. Only socialist delegates voted against the measures. The OAK was given an ultimatum to call off the strike by 5 p.m. on November 13th. At 2 a.m. of November 14th, the committee and the socialist leadership complied, calling on workers to resume their work on Friday, November 15th. The committee's decision was unanimous, except for Grimm. The strike had already been called off when it claimed its first lives. In Grenchen, a town in the canton of Solothurn, protesting workers were tearing up railroad tracks when soldiers shot at them. 3 died and more were injured. In Basel and Zurich, workers initially refused to believe news of the strike's end. Schneider traveled to Basel to convince them to return to work. In Zurich, the labor movement, led by Ernst Nobs, was incensed by the decision to end the strike and considered ignoring it. Eventually, moderates prevailed, but in some factories, work did not resume until the next Monday. The 1918 general strike was the most significant domestic crisis in Switzerland since the Sonderbund War of 1847. In early 1919, 21 leaders were put on trial for incitement to mutiny. Grimm, Schneider, and Fritz Platten were convicted for their involvement in the publication and dissemination of the pamphlet calling for the general strike. Specifically, the proclamation contained a call for soldiers to ignore orders to shoot workers. They were sentenced to 6 months in prison. Nobs was convicted because of a different text he published, which was found to be subversive. He was sentenced to a 4-week prison term. All 4 served their sentences, while the other 17 defendants were acquitted. And in the end, Grimm would use this to catapult his political career, culminating in 1946, when he became the president of the Swiss National Council. In the end, the general strike of 1918, while not a high watermark for the Swiss communist movement, would mark the last great attempt at full-scale revolution. In the end, workers secured a few of their demands, namely the 48-hour work week and pay increases, and it is perhaps fitting that even at its most militant, Swiss revolutions end in compromise. The rest of the interwar years were far less eventful than this, but still deserved their own share of coverage. Following the conclusion of the war, the westernmost chunk of Austria, an area known as Vorarlberg, petitioned the Swiss government for integration as the 23rd canton. This was then reaffirmed when a region-wide referendum concluded with nearly 80% of residents in favor. In the end, though, the move was rejected, as both French and German Protestants worried about giving membership to German Catholics, who, I will remind you, had very recently started a civil war. At the same time, the small principality of Liechtenstein, still an independent state, concluded a customs duty with Switzerland, wherein it would adopt the Swiss currency and postal system. To this day, Liechtenstein functions as a junior partner to the Swiss state, an unofficial canton with its own government. Following the general strikes of 1918, the Swiss population finally accepted the introduction of proportional representation in parliament. This move would help spark the rise of various small political parties in Switzerland. For American observers, or even British, where essentially two parties hold control over political agendas, the amount of Swiss parties with significant representation is a bit astounding. Their first election with such a system were held in 1919, with the Radicals losing their absolute majority for the first time since 1848. The Conservative Catholics, the forerunners to the PDC, and Socialists each won roughly a quarter of the seats, while a fifth went to the Self-Employed Party, later the UDC or SVP, and the remainder going to a smattering of anti-socialist parties. On the international scale, Switzerland found itself in a continuation of its previous legacy. The Treaty of Versailles reaffirmed the state's neutrality, and the state found itself becoming the host of the League of Nations based in Geneva. A year later, the Swiss would nearly vote to join the organization. It thus soon played host to the Geneva Conventions, the one you probably think of, which banned use of chemical weapons and required discrimination between combatants and non-combatants. Economically, the state endured two crises, the first from 1920 to 1925, and the second as part of the Great Depression from 1930 to 1936. As a result, textiles, watchmaking, and banking all suffered severely. In response, the Federal Council devalued the franc to promote exports, though this move did little to help the situation. It then instituted a federal income tax in order to fund public works projects, which would help push the state out from this downturn. Some sectors, like mechanical engineering, were practically unaffected, as the state underwent infrastructure projects, including the electrification of the rail system and development of hydropower plants. This would prove successful enough that Switzerland became energy independent during this period, which would prove critical during the coming conflict. Between economic downturns, the Swiss banking industry managed to thrive off of its perceived stability between 1914 and 1918. This was further aided by banking secrecy, enshrined into law in 1934, which allowed people to place money within Swiss banks without fear of it being confiscated or taxed. But as the interwar years began to wind down, it was clear that conflict lay on the horizon. The rise of a new movement, fascism, created a new radical end to right-leaning politics. Among the founders of the movement was one Benito Mussolini, a former socialist who had fled his home country of Italy to come to Switzerland, where he abandoned his beliefs and adopted a new system based on nationalism and authoritarianism. Ironically, Switzerland saw this movement as far less of a threat than socialism, and the University of Lausanne even awarded Mussolini an honorary doctorate. Still, it became clear to everyone that conflict was becoming inevitable. Switzerland began to dig itself in, double down on its absolute neutrality, and distance itself from the League of Nations. To survive, Switzerland would have to become an island. Before I end this episode, I want to talk briefly about the conclusion to our run with Switzerland. If all goes according to schedule, the last episode will be released just over 1 year after the first, which means I plan on covering about 3 more episodes, not including this one. I'm intentionally cutting myself off after the conclusion of World War II, because after that, the show would become far more about contemporary politics than actual history. So, the timeline for us will be as follows. one episode on the military side of World War II, one on the social, economic, and political side during and after the conflict, and then one episode quickly running us through the years between 1945 and today, a grand finale of sorts. After that, my plan is to split up the time between Switzerland and the next big series I do with a little mini-series on a country. I already have one in mind, and I think the end result will be one big 45-minute episode covering the entire thing. If that sounds infeasible, I just ask that you wait for it to come out, and I think you'll see why I did it this way. Given the format, I'll probably end up taking a 2-week break between the conclusion of this series and the release of that. Once it does come out, I'll probably take another 2-week break, and when I return, we will launch into the next full-length series. So, that's the plan for the future. I'm not going anywhere yet. Join us next time as Switzerland fights desperately to keep themselves afloat in a sea of fascist Germany. Until then, share the show, rate the show, subscribe to the show, send me emails at historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com, and until next time, pozdragnanja, ciao, and goodbye.